Well, good morning. This is Per Fagrang, and the program is Fight the Empire. And our guest is William Pepper, who is a colleague of Martin Luther King in the peace movement. And he was the attorney for the King family when they bought a very landmark lawsuit. And he also has written two books about the assassination, Orders to Kill and An Active State. William Pepper, welcome to KABU.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Well, it's been 43 years now since Dr. King was assassinated. Why don't we start? A lot of people are probably not even alive when this happened, our listeners. So why don't we start out, sort of describe the whole thing if we can. Why don't we start with James Earl Ray when he escaped from a Missouri prison in April 1967, almost a year before the assassination. He escaped from prison, and he made his way to Montreal. Why don't we pick up the story there?
Okay, that'll be fine. I mean, James escaped from prison. We now know that he was profiled for this operation before his escape was facilitated. His escape was facilitated. He didn't realize that. We didn't realize it for a long time. And it's only relatively new information that's come to us that's enabled us to put the details together of how his escape was facilitated, how he was profiled at the request of Edgar Hoover, and how money was brought from the Bureau to a Dixie Mafia family who had worked for Hoover on many operations before, but particularly with Clyde Tolson. Tolson seemed to have been the point man who would come in. He was, as you know, Hoover's number two at the Bureau. And he carried the money in, and the money was taken to the prison, was turned over to the warden, and we had an eyewitness who was at that time the son of the family that was working with Hoover on the ground locally in Memphis. So James the escape then was facilitated. He headed toward Canada, worked for a period of time.
And, he escaped. He was sort of hiding in a bread truck or something, wasn't he?
He was allowed to get into a bread truck and was taken off the prison grounds, delivery truck. He headed toward into Illinois and up to Canada. Eventually, found his way to Montreal, and it was his desire to get out of North America entirely. He was looking to get on a merchant ship, one way or another. And get out of North America, and he had in mind going to Africa actually, at that point in time. He ran into a guy who, of course, the state has always said never existed, but we know not only that he existed, and we know where he lives. So this fellow James came to know as Raoul. Ran into this fellow Raoul. And who seemed to befriend him and offered him money and promised to get him travel documents, but first wanted him to help out with some smuggling operations into the United States and then into Mexico and back from Mexico into the United States. He gave James money for a car, $2,000 for a car, which he bought in Birmingham, Alabama, and pretty much kept James on a string for quite a period of time. Now, we know Raoul existed, and he's not a figment of anyone's imagination, because a merchant seaman named Sid Carthew, a British merchant seaman, ran into this same guy around the same time at this bar on the near the docks in West Commissioner Street in Montreal. And when Sid saw the television documentary, well, it wasn't a documentary, it was a television trial, was done in a docu drama fashion with a totally unscripted television trial that we did back in 1993. When Sid saw that, it was on Channel 4 in England and HBO in the States. He contacted me and he said, you know, all those people who are saying there's no such person as Raoul, he said, I don't know what they're talking about, because I met the same guy and he was talking to me about buying guns because he had an access to weapons.
So did the FBI track James Earl Ray to Montreal? I mean,
well, James movements were tracked. We don't we don't know the details and all of it, but he was being monitored clearly.
And if he got someplace else, Raoul would have met him there then.
Well, James was steered toward Canada and steered toward. He'd always had in mind that he could get a passport in Canada somehow and get out. He just had to get out of the United States, and then he thought he could make arrangements from Canada. So he was being guided. One of the things about James is that whilst he identified Raoul as the person who was handling him throughout this operation. He was very reluctant to involve other people who he thought, legitimately were trying to help him. He doesn't want to drag people in. He's had this kind of mentality that's not unusual with cons, that he just didn't want to involve people who he thought were just honestly trying to help him. So I'm sure that he withheld a great deal of information from everyone over the years in terms of these kinds of people.
So Raoul hires James on this so-called smuggling operation, has him traveling around the U.S. and into Mexico. And let's skip ahead. He has James Earl Ray coming to, Birmingham and then Memphis.
Yeah, well, he was in Los Angeles for a long time. And some military guys, special ops guys, became aware of, told us they were in Los Angeles for quite a period of time because they thought the assassination was going to take place in Los Angeles, and it apparently was planned originally to take place in Los Angeles, and so they kept James there for quite a period of time. That's one of the indications. They kept him there for quite a long period of time, and then. All of a sudden, he was advised to move and went into New Orleans, Atlanta, bought the gun in Birmingham, and then, as you say, he moved into Memphis. They switched the place of assassination to Memphis. Now, one can only speculate why that was the case. I tend to think it was the case because they had also planned to assassinate Bob Kennedy, the same forces. Planned to assassinate Bob Kennedy in Los Angeles, and just wouldn't do to have two assassinations in the same city. They had very good connections with police forces and local police forces and authorities in both cities. So it was no question that could have been done in either city. And Martin actually flew into Memphis around the 18th of March out of Detroit. And just about the time he flew in, James left. So that takes care of the whole stalking theory that James was stalking Martin King. Not only was he not in Detroit and a lot of other places, but when Martin came into Los Angeles, James left.
So James Earl Ray comes to Memphis, and let's set the scene there. The motel where Martin Luther King stayed, the Lorraine Motel, was on Mulberry Street. And one block away is South Main Street, and there's a rooming house, and there's Jim's Grill on the bottom floor of the rooming house. And from the back of that rooming house is this sort of empty yard facing Mulberry Street, and it's kind of high up. There's an 8-foot retaining wall onto the street. So from that backyard, you have a perfect view of the sort of the courtyard and the motel.
Yeah, and it was filled. It was heavily filled with bushes and brush and undergrowth, it wasn't a vacant lot. I mean, it was vacant in the sense that nothing was built on it, but mm-hmm. it was just overrun with bushes and mm-hmm. very, very heavily shrouded. And so it was a good spot for the sniper to lay in wait.
So let's talk about Lloyd Jowers now.
Well, Jowers was the owner or the manager of Jim's Grill, and he ran the grill, and it backed into this brushy area. What we eventually came to learn was that Jowers had been contacted by Frank Liberto. Who was a local mobster, a part of the Marcello family. And Liberto was given a role to play in terms of organizing some of these actions right on the ground. And he contacted Jowers, delivered arranged for quite a bit of money to be delivered to him. There were a couple of planning sessions right in the grill itself attended by some members of the police, Memphis police force, and it was set up that James, of course, would come to Memphis. He'd rent a room in that rooming house, and they would structure an assassination fiction that he shot Martin from the bathroom window on the second floor of the rooming house, and. In actual fact, James was kept out of the rooming house by Raoul most of the day. He was sent to get some binoculars. He was told to go off and go to a movie and various things like that happened. And in fact, James left the rooming house area. He was parked in front of Jim's Grill. He left it about 20 minutes to 6, somewhere around there, 20 to 6, quarter to 6. And we know this because we have statements from two alibi witnesses who were in the grill, came out and saw the car parked there, inspected it even, because one of them was interested in buying a Mustang like one James had. And then they started to walk up the street, and when they got up South Main Street, two blocks to a cross street called Vance, as they were about to cross that street, that Mustang, the same Mustang, came right around the corner, almost clipped one of them. So they and was driven by a lone driver.
Let me take a quick break here. This is Fight the Empire on KBOO. My guest is William Pepper, author of An Act of State. Now, Raoul told James to go to a movie or something, but instead James decided he had a flat tire that needed fixing. And he tried to do that, and he couldn't fix it. The gas station guy was busy. And so James is going to come back to the rooming house, but by that time, the place was full of police, and he was turned away, and he kind of left town.
Yeah, he drove away after that. Mm-hmm. He was nowhere around the scene. In fact, when he heard the ambulance sirens when he was at the gas station trying to get his car. It was a spare tire, and mm-hmm. he decided on his own to get it repaired because he thought Raoul was going to use the car, mm-hmm. and he thought, oh, you know, if something happened, he had a flat tire, he wouldn't have a spare because the spare was flat, so he wanted to get it fixed, and he thought he was doing a good job for Raoul, but he couldn't get it done in time, and he heard the siren, something was going on, so he started to drive back down to the rooming house area, and he was basically turned away by the police who had were blocking the street off, Main Street off at that point in time. So then he just drove off.
Well, he heard on the car radio that King had been killed, and they were looking for a white man in a Mustang. And he sort of did he put things together then? And
he basically started to realize uh-huh. that he had been set up.
Let's talk about Lloyd Jowers' confession.
Yeah, well, Lloyd was a desperate man, and actually Lloyd's a very nasty piece of work. In a lot of ways, he took the money. He participated in this. His job was to take the rifle from the shooter, bring it back in, break it down, and let it be collected by one of Liberto's people. So Lloyd was very much involved in the whole conspiracy. He actually has admitted at various times and various people that he's the one, he said, who did the shooting. We don't believe that was the case for a minute, but he thought to admit to his involvement because we had several witnesses who came forward. One being, of course, Betty Spates, who saw him running into the back. She was standing right at the door. He ran right past her with the still smoking rifle, and he broke it down in front of her. Said, "You wouldn't do anything to hurt me, Betty, would you?" And you know, and she and he had been lovers, and she had worked on it off and on at the grill, and so. And she said, "No, of course I wouldn't, Lloyd." Well, it was 1992 before Betty was prepared to come forward and tell this story. So it was quite a long time after.
Now, one interesting thing is that Lloyd Jowers, he would have testified in a trial if he'd been given immunity.
Yes, he wanted to get immunity.
Tell us a little bit about that. In other words, the DA or the refused to do that, and so basically to stop Lloyd Jowers from ever testifying in a court in trial.
Well, they didn't want to hear the Jowers story. They didn't want to hear anything about any other option in the justice in this case or truth. They didn't want to hear any of that. And so the Shelby County District Attorney General just ignored it. We had a colleague of mine, Wayne Chastain, rest his soul, was sitting for 2 weeks outside the grand jury room trying to get in. We wanted to bring this to the grand jury, and we couldn't get in. But they were just determined to block it in every way they could and continue the cover-up, which they have to this day. Yeah. We did hold the television trial finally in 1999.
Tell us a little bit about that. That was quite a big project. You try to duplicate a real courtroom trial as much as possible.
Well, no, it was a real trial. It was an absolute. The one that was an actual television project was the one in 1993.
Mm-hmm.
That was an unscripted trial with a nationally chosen jury.
Mm-hmm.
But this 1999 trial was a civil action.
Right. Let's talk about the TV trial. I mean, you had a guy who was the judge.
Yeah, Marvin Frankel was the judge. Marvin was a retired federal judge, and he was the judge. Hickman Ewing was a former U.S. attorney from Memphis, and Hickman was the a prosecutor, and I was the defense counsel for James. And the trial went on. That one went for 10 days. The real civil action in 99 went on for 30 days. This went on for 10 days. And took the jury 7.5 hours to find James as not guilty. And whereas in the civil trial, it took the jury only 59 minutes to exonerate him. Yeah. So it's we had a fraction of the evidence, of course, in 6 years earlier, but that television trial then did bring out a lot of new witnesses and a lot of evidence.
Let's talk a little bit. There was a military sniper team in Memphis at that time also. They were on a rooftop nearby.
Well, yeah, there was an Alpha 184 team, and they had two snipers. One of them was on the Illinois Central Railroad building, on the roof of that building, with a spotter. Another one, we believe, was in the water tower, also with a spotter. And they were there, in my view, as a backup. I don't think Martin King was ever going to be allowed to leave Memphis.
Mm-hmm.
And if the non-military, I'm going to call him civilian sniper, didn't get Martin King, then one of those military guys were good.
But the civilian guy did, I guess, with one shot. Now, yeah. Do we know who he was? Dick Gregory was saying that he was a Memphis officer named Earl Clark. Is that true?
No. I don't believe it was Earl Clark. I mean, Earl Clark, I know Earl Clark was there.
Mm-hmm.
Earl Clark was in the bushes.
Mm-hmm.
And I know he was there. And I know he came down over the wall, and he ran north on Mulberry Street right after the shooting.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Clark's role was that of a spotter.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he was the shooter. No.
Also, one thing that came out since then was it was been revealed that a very well-known photographer named Ernest Withers, who had been covering civil rights things for years, was also an FBI informant, and that he was sort of tracking Dr. King and also reporting on the Reverend James Lawson, who was a local minister. Does that have any bearing on this?
Well, I think it's a part of the total picture. I mean, Martin's organization was infiltrated. He was surrounded by traitors.
Mm-hmm.
And he was infiltrated. There were informants all over the place who were working for SCLC, and also in Memphis. You know, and people were providing information to both the FBI and the local police about Dr. King's movements and everything that was going on.
Yeah. Well, one of them was actually photographed. His name was Merrill McCullough. And he was actually working with the Memphis police. He was the young African American guy who was kind of kneeling over King's body after he was shot. And he was one of the informants too, wasn't he?
Well, he was he was in a different situation because he was actually an undercover.
Mm-hmm.
He was an undercover intelligence agent. He was working for his primarily working for military intelligence. He had been called back to active duty, but he was in Memphis. He went to police academy, trained for being a police officer, and was a police officer. And he was working for Memphis Police Department Intelligence. So he had Merrill McCullough had those dual roles, and he had infiltrated a group called the Invaders, a black group who were, Black Panther, black liberation kind of group who were very active and who were trying to work with Dr. King on this particular march.
Mm-hmm.
And they were told to leave the hotel within 15 minutes of the shooting. Housekeeper came, knocked on the door and said, "You have to go. SCLC is not going to pay your bill." And this was around 5:45. So what are you talking about? I mean, the day is well beyond the checkout time. And said, "Oh, you got to go." They said, "Well, who told you we got to go? They thought they were preparing a march, the march with Dr. King. They're working very, very closely with him." And she said, "Oh no, I've been given instructions. You have to go." "Well, who gave you the instructions?" She said, "Reverend Jackson gave me the instructions." So Jesse Jackson was the one that orchestrated the removal of the Invaders. I think the Invaders were a dangerous group for any kind of...
Well, was that true about Reverend Jackson, or was that something somebody said?
Izzy Harrington told me that's... one of the Invaders said that's exactly what she told him, the housekeeper.
Mm.
He was at the door, and she told him that. And he said he looked over his shoulder, and he saw Jackson down on the ground in the parking lot area looking at his watch. So... it was certainly true. I've asked Reverend Jackson about it. He doesn't remember anything about this, but I asked him. I believe he gave the instructions, and that's why the Invaders ran. And they were loose cannons. They were armed. They had weapons, and they were in on the same level as Martin King, just a little bit up the hallway, a little bit down the balcony. I think it was dangerous to have them there because. Mm-hmm. Who knows what they might have done, what they might have seen.
Well, we have only a couple minutes left, but I'd really like to say something about in 1978, Daniel Ellsberg had a conversation with a man named Brady Tyson, who I guess was on the U.S. Delegation to the U.N. or something, who told Ellsberg that we know who did it, and it was a gang of FBI men under the personal direction of J. Edgar Hoover. Can you quickly say something about that?
Well, I think the I think the Hoover involvement is clear. He was Hoover's office through Tolson, only through Tolson. Tolson was the one that ran things in Memphis, but Hoover was clearly involved in this. They were not FBI men who killed King. FBI's role in the assassination was after the fact in terms of covering it up. They took control of the investigation. That was their job to cover it up. So it was they were not people who were involved in the shooting.
And the CIA provided Raoul.
Raoul worked for both the he worked for the agency, but he also worked for Carlos Marcello.
Marcello was the New Orleans mob boss. Apparently, other mob bosses had turned down an offer to eliminate Dr. King, but I guess Marcello accepted it.
Marcello worked very closely with the government in terms of that assassination. Mm-hmm.
Well, if people want to, do you have any kind of a website on regarding this where people can get more information?
Well, I don't. I just try not to get involved with websites. Mm-hmm. That people can read. There are two books out, and there's a third one coming out. I'm preparing it because it's the basis of a lot of new evidence and new information. The new book will be called The Prayer List, and The Prayer List is a list of three names on the back of a card that was written by Clyde Tolson and given to this particular mafia Dixie Mafia family.
When is that coming out?
Well, the book will probably be out. It'll be about a year. Mm-hmm. The three names on the list are JFK, MLK, and RFK.
Uh-huh. Okay. I think we're going to have to leave it there. We've been talking with William Pepper, author of An Act of State and Orders to Kill, also the lawyer for the King family in their successful lawsuit against Lloyd Jowers and other persons. The jury ruled that this was a conspiracy. I wish we had time to get into that, but thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
This is a story that should not be forgotten, should not be allowed to vanish from people's awareness. So thanks a lot for being with us.
You're welcome. Good to talk to you.